Welcome to EAN Cast, your weekly source for education, research, and updates from the European Academy of Neurology.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the EAN Cast Weekly Neurology Podcast. My name is Veronica Cabrera. I'm a consultant neurologist and clinical researcher at San João University Hospital in Porto, Portugal. This month on the EAN Cast, we are focusing on functional neurological disorders, and particularly in today's episode, we'll be discussing education and training in FND across Europe, where we are, where the gaps remain, and how we might move forward. I'm delighted to be joined by two internationally recognized experts. I'm sure you know them. Professor Mark Edwards is a professor of neurology and interface disorders and a consultant neurologist at King's College Hospital in London. And also Professor Stone, who is a consultant neurologist and honorary professor of neurology in Edinburgh, Scotland. Welcome and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
Thank you very much, Veronica.
So maybe we could start by, I would like our listeners to kind of understand why we decided to do a podcast on this topic. And I will start by kind of setting the scene for our listeners by looking at where we are currently at the moment in terms of FND education across Europe and the heterogeneities in terms of training. And particularly this episode was inspired by a study published by Dr. Teresa Serranova from Prague. Teresa led a study that tried to look at regional differences in FND education and training across Europe. And the study gathered data from 25 countries. And it's impressed that the study found that only five of these countries included FND as part of their neurology curriculum. So, John, you were actually both the senior authors of this paper, but I'll start by asking John, would you like to comment on this paper, John, and this finding and briefly summarize what you found in this study?
Yeah, so I guess we were inspired by the apparent disparity between how common FND is in all of our practices as neurologists, but how rarely it seemed to appear in training. I was excited a few years ago to see that FND is actually part of the EAN recommended curriculum for neurology trainees. But talking to colleagues around Europe, it didn't seem that that had necessarily translated into what was happening on the ground. So we wanted to see as best we could what is happening on the ground. And as you said, we managed to get some kind of information from 25 countries. And only in five of those was FND a mandatory part of neurological training. And we contrasted that with MS, which of course was uniformly in all training programs. So it only appeared in three final neurology examinations that we could see, that we had information about. And we could only 17 of those countries had any neurologists with an interest in FND. When we tried to get some idea of the relative frequency of sort of FND neurologists versus MS neurologists, the ratio that we came up to was 1 in 20. So there are 20 times as many MS neurologists. And that's not because MS is 20 times more common than FND. So those were some of the headlines from the study. And it was really just to try and get people to think about their training and can we get a bit more equity in training and representation for this disorder.
Striking, isn't it? And I was interested particularly in that aspect that you just mentioned. Would you like to explain further why you selected MS as a comparator? Because it's interesting, right? If we look at the prevalence of both conditions.
So, but the incidence of MS is certainly appears to be less than that of FND. The prevalence may be more similar. People with MS have quite a similar condition. They're multiple symptoms of a long-term condition, many of them. So we thought that was that would be an interesting comparison.
Yeah. And what about you, Mark? Did any of these findings of the study surprise you at all? Or were you already expecting this kind of systematic gaps that we identify in our clinical practice as well?
Yeah, it wasn't, unfortunately, it wasn't particularly surprising. But I think it is important to put it out there. I think lots of us know, including people who are not maybe not particularly interested in FND, but recognize that FND is really quite common. It's something which often people describe as challenging or difficult. And so it's recognized as a thing and a difficult and challenging thing in neurological practice. So it is a bit irrational that there's such a lack of training and preparation for people who are going to be seeing people with this condition very frequently in their lives, in their working lives, that they don't get preparation and support to do that. And I think it's part of this ongoing issue about whether this thing, functional neurological disorder, the people that have it, are they really the business of a neurologist? And there's I think still an ongoing tension about that. And I think that underlies some of the negative attitudes and feelings that people have towards people with FND. They feel that I've got lots of other people I should be treating. Why am I having to treat these people with this condition, which is not my responsibility? But I think that, you know, over the past number of years, there has been a successful and correct, in my opinion, push towards saying, well, neurologists do have a really important role to play, not just in the diagnostic labeling of the condition, but also in terms of the involvement in management, in advocacy, in training, as one would for any other condition that causes neurological symptoms.
Yeah, so really, if we try to summarize this, we're really talking about one of the most common conditions that we see in neurology clinics and also in other settings, emergency department, and even in the ward. So it's everywhere as well. And John obviously led, and you as well, led some of the most important studies in terms of FND prevalence. But despite that, we still see that FND is thoroughly underrepresented in the training programs. And it's not just a thing of one or two countries, is actually very systematic. So I would like us to kind of do a step back and try to think. I know you already introduced some of those issues, Mark, but I would like us to have a deep thought about the possible underlying reasons and why this has persisted for so long, because you both have tried to push for this for the last 20 years or more. So why do you think that FND is still so underrepresented in comparison to other conditions?
Well, shall I kick off there? I mean, we've got lots of things going on here. I mean, one of the key things is the history of the disorder and how really for over 100 years it was really considered a purely psychiatric condition and the responsibility of psychiatrists, and almost a feeling, certainly I had this when I was training, that these patients were in the wrong place, and although they had neurological symptoms, they have a psychiatric disorder, and it's really not the business of a neurologist to be looking after them. And some of this, it comes back to interesting history, really, of when neurology and psychiatry diverged, particularly with the advent of neuropathology. I think many neurologists were tying their profession, if you like, to pathology. So the business of a neurologist is to look for a neurological pathology, and if there isn't one, well, then that's not what we do. So I think those sort of ideas have been very much in play and still are, I think, for many people. Whereas what Mark was saying, which I obviously agree with, is that the business of a neurologist is to help people who've got neurological symptoms work out what they are. And they might be a structural pathology, but they might not be. So I think when you put it that way, it becomes a bit clearer about why some people are uncomfortable in this area. But then you've got the added business of the fact that because it has been and still is coded as a psychiatric disorder, that creates all sorts of difficulties for training, for access to payments, for conditions, for benefits. So these patients sort of sit in a sort of no man's land in between the two, or at least don't have done historically.
Yeah. And from speaking with other neurologists as well, and particularly trainees, I also feel that there is a sense that perhaps we need better diagnostic signs and also treatments. And this kind of sense of diagnostic uncertainty and unclear diagnosis contributes to the lack of more formal and established training. Do you think that this could be part of why this has continued for so long?
Mark wants a comment, I'm sure, but I think that's not what's going on here. Because you look at a lot of our other conditions that we manage, like migraine, for example, or many forms of movement disorder, they also are clinical diagnoses which have similar levels of unreliability, and we have to make clinical So I think there's been an issue with this not being in part of training and people not knowing how to diagnose it, and that information hasn't been out there, and we need to do better to get it out there. But the ways we've got of making a diagnosis are fairly well established, and many of them were well known, 100 years ago, but they kind of got forgotten. But I don't think the argument that it's harder to diagnose really washes. I don't think it is. I think it's just a training issue personally. But I don't know, perhaps Mark, I don't know if you agree with that.
No, I do agree with you. I mean, I think that we're as neurologists, in training, as trained neurologists, even with lots of expertise, there's high levels of uncertainty in neurological practice. We're used to dealing with that, used to holding lots of uncertainty. So don't think that's so much the issue. I think it is the thing you were talking about before, that somehow there's still this very strong, neurology is neuropathology, and that's our core business. But when you think about it, that is wrong for most of the people we see, because most of the people that we see with neurological conditions, which might be underpinned by pathology, have significant psychological or psychiatric comorbidities and risk factors and maintaining factors. So in fact, I've felt over time that the training that I've had from seeing lots of people with functional neurological disorder and interacting with other professionals like psychiatrists and psychologists and physios and so on, that's been fantastic training for managing people with with neurological conditions generally, outside of functional neurological disorder. So I think actually this provides a really important rebalancing of that old sort of pathological approach to what neurology is, to something which is actually more in line with what it actually is for all neurological conditions.
Yeah, and I would go further actually to say, in the era of MRI and whole genome sequences, anybody can order a scan. Anybody can request a few blood tests. You can ask ChatGPT, give me a few blood tests for this patient. That bit of neurology is still fascinating and great, but it's there's a lot. This aspect of neurology that we're talking about is the stuff that is much harder for AI to do, I think.
Absolutely. And perhaps we could now move to other findings of this study that I also found particularly interesting. One of them is regional differences in terms of access to specialist services, for example. We haven't touched on that yet. Reimbursement, even issues like the historical divide between neurology and psychiatry, and other cultural aspects that we know diverge between countries. So starting with you, Mark, you have been in contact with trainees from all over the world. You have influenced the field worldwide, I would say, and you regularly contact with these people. So what do you see are the major gaps in terms of training exposure and particularly from those that seek further training from you in the UK?
So I think that starting with a positive thing, both in the UK and outside, I have seen a massive change, and I'm sure John has, in the general interest in functional neurological disorder, with a training neurologist and other trainees being much more kind of willing to think about, well, this could be an important part of my job, or maybe even I want to kind of subspecialize in this. So there's a lot of interest. I think that one of the things which is a really kind of chilling influence, like that really keeps everything so stuck, I think, are the sort of systematic problems that there are that make managing people with functional neurological disorder really quite difficult. And those are present in most countries to a greater or lesser extent. And lots of that has to do with a lack of integration of different services around particularly neurological and psychiatric services, but then also rehabilitative services, both in a sort of specialist context, but also at a community level. And also the sort of ongoing kind of fragmentation of medicine in general. So when you've got a condition which almost by its nature has symptoms across multiple systems and is usually associated with psychiatric comorbidity, often associated or can be associated with psychosocial stress and difficulty, then these systems that we work within in healthcare really kind of show their problems and show how inadequate they are. And so once you've kind of dipped your toe into that and tried to do the right thing and realized how difficult it can be, it's not surprising that many people say, well, look, I'm not going to do this. Or even worse, they really try to do it and they get really burnt out by trying to do it because it's just really, really difficult to fight against this system. So I think that's something which is there across countries. You know, I think the more that the medical leadership can kind of promote this condition, promote its importance. That's why that's so important. So, for example, the fact that the EAN has a scientific committee about functional neurological disorder, that's new. The fact that the EAN is supporting European guidelines for functional neurological disorder, the talks at conferences, you know, supporting local things in every country. All of that builds this sort of power that this is a thing we should be doing something about, and will feed through eventually into changes in policy output.
Yeah, I think this is a good moment actually to pause and actually invite our listeners to join our panel. So as Mark was saying, there is a new panel, a new coordinating panel of DAN focused on functional neurological disorders, and all of our listeners are invited to join and get involved. There are a lot of new activities coming out, including the guidelines, which obviously will hopefully help guide clinical practice, not only in Europe, but worldwide. But John, again, if we step back for a little while, you have been doing some work on stigma, and I know you are very passionate about. And we were describing how lack of education and access to training might shape the interaction between clinicians and patients. So in short, would you like to talk to us about how you think that education might play a role in reducing stigma for the future?
Yeah, well, I think it's interesting because a lot of the work on stigma has focused on health professionals and how we do and have historically really stigmatized this problem. But the stigma is out there in society as well. It's out there in anything to do with a whiff of mental health. And some studies that Quiver McLaughlin did from our group showed actually one of the most stigmatizing places for people is actually work, more than when they come to the hospital. So it is, and then there's also the issue that patients self-stigmatize. So they often will say, oh, I think this is all me, I'm doing it to myself, even when they're not. So sort of quite a lot of self-blame going on. So these are difficult problems to overcome. I don't think there's quick solutions to them. I think the culture of neurological practice is sort of handed down from supervisor to trainee, often over a very long period. If I think about my supervisor when I was training in the 90s, he was at medical school in the 60s, gaining attitudes from people who trained in the 1930s. So it doesn't take long to go right back. And I don't think we can expect this to change anytime soon. But I think what does change it, as Mark said, is leadership, seeing that it's okay to be interested in FND. It's okay to be a neurologist who does this. I was really pleased to see that more than I thought, actually, five national neurological societies had special interest groups for FND. There were more specialist services than I thought there were going to be. There were more patient organizations out there. I think the overall picture might look grim, but it would have looked much, it would have been totally invisible, I think, if we'd done this 10, 15 years ago. So you can, change can occur. You only have to look at a condition like autism, which when I was training was a kind of horrendous thing that you would never mention and only affected, you know, you thought of children with severe learning disability, to see how that pendulums can swing unexpectedly. In fact, we have to be careful about that as well. But so I think the leadership, the research is really important. I think for neurologists, seeing that there is a scientific basis to this, that we can gain evidence-based treatment and diagnosis, or we can support that with the laboratory. There's a neuroscience and a pathophysiology. All of these things help to overcome that stigma, I think, and make people interested in something which is inherently interesting as well.
Mm-hmm. And looking ahead, do you perhaps, Mark, do you see any role for novel educational tools, like, for example, using digital methods, AI? Are you using any of those?
Not particularly, but that might be my increasing age. I think that may have a even greater role in just trying to get a different message out there, not just to trainees, but to society in general. Because I agree with John that there's problems with stigma within health professionals, for sure. But there is this general societal stigma that is just the same. You know, physical things are the real thing. That stuff you can see on a scan, anything you can't see is a little bit suspect or very suspect and can't be real. And just trying to change that view. And that may be where, you know, greater use of digital media, social media would be important to get a different message out there, because that message is very rife on social media as well, and gives a really negative view of these sorts of problems to patients who might be looking up about their condition. And I would extend that beyond functional neurological disorder to more broadly chronic symptoms, functional chronic symptoms, persistent physical symptoms. But there's a different narrative that could get out there, which is that this is a real condition, but actually these are things that people can also recover from and can improve from. And that's a message that almost never gets out there. So I think, yeah, maybe there's room for that kind of message more on from a more general social media point of view.
Perfect. And perhaps before we finish, I would like us to finish on a very practical note. So I would invite you both, first John, to just provide maybe two practical steps for any department across Europe, steps that could be taken to improve education for their trainees, perhaps things you have done in the past. And it can range from integrated care pathways, seeking funding, organizing courses. What do you think are two steps that could be taken for someone looking forward to start this locally?
Well, thinking broader than a department, if there's any trainees listening to this who want to do something practical, I would go to your national society and say, can we have a FND special interest group, and collecting others with the same interest? Because and very simple things like, can we make sure there's a section in the poster session for FND, for one of our commonest conditions? Can you make material for patients in your language? Because I think that also helps clinicians feel more positive about the condition. Can you introduce, does your local curriculum have FND? Is there a training day or session on it? If not, can you contact your regional training director and say, can we have one, please? Can it be organized? So those are some things I might encourage people to do.
Yeah. And I think, yeah, I mean, as well as that, I'm sure I definitely agree with, I think another thing you could think about doing is collecting some data, some local data, So that's something which is usually possible to just do an audit. How many people with functional neurological disorder are turning up in outpatient clinic or in the emergency department or being admitted to the hospital? How many patients on ITU have functional seizures that have been intubated incorrectly? So these sorts of things. So first, or on the hyperacute stroke unit for that matter as well. So these are ways of showing locally that, look, it's a problem for us too. These people, it's really common. And one step beyond that can be to look at the costs as well. So there's obviously costs to the individual, but there are costs to the health system. And in previous studies, those costs have been demonstrated to be really high. And lots of them are associated with acute care. So multiple attendances, admissions, ITU stays, and so on. So even just looking at, you know, how, you know, the last 20 people with FND, how much did that cost the system? What could we have done differently? So that, I think, forces maybe people higher up in the organization to take notice and to say, look, this is really common. It's really costly. We could be doing something different.
Yes, and perhaps an important note as well is not restricting these special interest groups to neurologists only, and actually join forces with allied healthcare professionals such as physiotherapists, OT, occupational therapy, speech and language therapy, and so on. I think is really important because without accessible treatment, it's really difficult. Okay, so I think we have reached our time, and unfortunately this episode has come to an end. I would like to thank our listeners for joining our discussion. This has been really interesting. And it's clear, I hope, for everyone that education in FND is not just an academic issue or a boring topic. It really has a real impact for patients. And I hope we have inspired clinicians, especially those in training across Europe, to join FND and our panel again, and to reflect more broadly on these issues and how we can really improve lives of patients with functional neurological disorders. So thank you again for joining us, and I hope you'll tune in for the next episode.
This has been EAN Cast Weekly Neurology. Thank you for listening. Be sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred podcatcher for weekly updates from the European Academy of Neurology. You can also listen to this and all of our previous episodes on the EAN campus to gain points and become an EAN expert in any of our 29 neurological specialties. Simply become an EAN individual member to gain access. For more information, visit ean.org/membership. That's ean.org/membership. Thanks for listening. EAN Cast Weekly Neurology is your unbiased and independent source for educational and research-related neurological content. Although all content is provided by experts in their field, it should not be considered official medical advice.